Risky Business. Risky Business. Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business, sponsored this week by Microsoft and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. I'm your host, Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we'll be hearing from an industry legend, Dan Gear. Now, Dan has served as the Chief Technology Officer of AtStake, then at Vertasys as Chief Scientist, and now his current post is as the Chief Information Security Officer for InQtel, which is, of course, the not-for-profit venture capital fund established by the CIA to invest in technologies that could be useful to the agency. But I should stress that Dan is in no way appearing on Risky Business as a representative of InQtel or any government agency. He's a security geek, not a spymaster. Okay? So the interview is just us having a chat about an interesting concept, which is that of the military digital complex, which seems to be emerging alongside the good old-fashioned military-industrial complex. In this week's sponsor interview, we'll hear from Microsoft's Steve Lipner. He's pretty much the company's big kahuna when it comes to all things SDL, or Secure Development Lifecycle. Well, next month, Microsoft is making a lot of its SDL tools available to independent software vendors, and Steve will be along to tell us why, and what people can expect to get their mitts on. But first, it's time for the news. And the computer network used by the World Bank Group has suffered a series of at least six intrusions since mid-2007, CNET reports. The World Bank Group was first notified of the intrusions by the FBI in September 2007, when the Bureau was investigating another cybercrime case involving transactions out of Johannesburg, South Africa. Fox News says it has an internal memo describing the initial intrusion to World Bank Group employees. Now, if you actually look at some of those PDFs that have come out of this thing, the World Bank will actually be doing rolling password resets internally, and here's the funny part, they'll be sending out emails to enforce the policy. Now, if that isn't conditioning your users for a spear phishing attack, then I don't know what is. Good one, World Bank. A Northern Territory hacker who allegedly caused millions of dollars of damage to government systems this week blamed stress for his crime, according to reports in News Limited newspapers. David Anthony McIntosh, 27, allegedly hacked in and shut down several Northern Territory government databases on May 5. Prosecutor Sergeant Eric Sims told the Darwin Magistrates Court McIntosh deleted 10,475 NT public servant user accounts. Ouch. McIntosh is alleged to have breached the systems of CSG, a large Darwin-based ICT firm, a month after he quit his job at the company. And he faces up to 10 years jail and a $50,000 fine if convicted. And ZDNet UK reports that security giant Symantec has announced it will acquire Message Labs. Symantec has agreed to purchase Message Labs for $695 million in cash. The agreement is subject to regulatory approval, but the deal should close by the end of the year, Symantec says. So, to all of you Message Labs people listening, start getting fitted up for your yellow suits. And that's it for the news. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
Sick of dealing with email archiving to keep the compliance gods happy? Message Labs Managed Email Archiving Service is a proven email archiving solution that makes mailbox management, e-discovery, email compliance and supervision a cinch. Our email archive safely and securely stores all internal and external emails and enables search and email retrieval to be completed in seconds. Let us make your email compliance our problem, not yours. Find out more at messagelabs.com.au.
And of course, in the interests of transparency, we must disclose that Message Labs, as you just heard, and Microsoft, which were two companies mentioned in the news, are Risky Business advertisers and sponsors. Now, before we get into this week's feature interview, there's something I would like to address. Last week, I did an interview with Dennis Cox from Breaking Point Systems about the Outpost 24 TCP DOS thing. Now, if you haven't heard about it, the Outpost guys have apparently found a bug in TCP that allows them to DOS many different types of IP stacks very easily. Now, last week's report did actually contain an inaccuracy. I said that Dennis Cox's guess at the flaw had been debunked by the Outpost 24 researchers, Robert E. Lee and Jack Lewis, on their blog. Now, that was actually factually incorrect, and it's on me, so apologies to the guys for that. They have, of course, since debunked Dennis's guess, but hadn't at the time that we ran the story, and certainly not on their blog. Now, I've been in contact with Robert E. Lee, and arranged to—I had actually arranged to interview him for this week's show. he wanted to rebut some of the opinions that we expressed in last week's podcast. But for one reason or another, he was unable to answer the phone at the time we scheduled to speak. And subsequent attempts to reschedule the interview just didn't sort of work out. We just couldn't find a convenient time. But not to worry, the plan is we will get him on the show once the details of the bug he found, along with Jack Lewis, have been released. So keep listening. Moving on, and it's time for this week's feature interview with Dan Gear. As well as having served as CTO for AtStake and chief scientist for Vertices, he also ran the development arm of MIT's Project Athena, where his staff pioneered Kerberos and the X-Windows system. In other words, Dan has actually been around for a little while, and he's also a controversial figure. He was apparently fired, or at least asked to step down, from AtStake following the publication of his paper Cyber Insecurity, The Cost of Monopoly, a paper that suggested Microsoft's dominance in the operating system market was presenting a threat to national security. This was, of course, many years ago. But when Gear speaks, the point is people listen. And what Dan has to say is about a trend in our industry. It seems that as time goes on, various elements of the information security industry are becoming closer and closer to government agencies and militaries. In fact, it's all starting to look like a new military-industrial complex. The term military-industrial complex was first coined by US President Dwight D. Eisenhower during his farewell address in 1961. And here's the relevant 2 minutes.
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Well, there you go. It's pretty heavy stuff, pretty grave warnings. Now, in this interview, Dan Gear will argue the same trends are now forming in our industry, in the information security industry. And there are actually some parallels between the military-industrial complex and this new emerging military-digital complex.
The thing that I think that you should draw in parallel between that and the current situation is the number of things and people who, in a sense, are now as tied in with the same spirit as what he described. You know, the idea that there is a standing army was not, from his point of view, a good thing, and that he was worried about, as he left office, that somehow we'd come to have not just a standing army, but a large number of people who, in whatever way, were committed to the permanence of both military affairs and its interconnection with civilian life. And although there's been mountains of stuff written on his speech, I think the fact that a turn of phrase in his speech entered the vocabulary as easily as it did is indicative. Now, why do I think we're somewhere near that now? It seems to me that the erasure of borders, the degree to which, and I don't use the word globalization here because that is freighted with a whole other meaning, but the degree to which we're borderless in many ways now, perhaps is demonstrated in the last month by the issues with finance being provably borderless. Mm. But there's many other things that are borderless as well. And a sovereign nation would have to worry about that, because one of the things, of course, of sovereignty is knowing what is your territory and what isn't. And while there was a time when marching armies were the main threat to where your border was, that's not the case now. I would absolutely expect it to be normal for offense and defense to both be part of the digital security arena, not just defense, which of course is what's in the press, and it's what, you know, the antivirus companies exist, for example, to deal with is defense, but offense is going to be there. And whether you like it or not, this is not a radical thought. It's just, it's going to be there. There's going to be an offensive capability. There doubtless already is.
Well, I was about to say, this is not something that is, you know, that out there. I mean, I imagine that there are many government offensive sort of cyber attack teams, if you wanted to give them such a cheesy name.
Correct. I'm sure there are such out there. And it would be the rare country that had the capability of doing so that didn't invest in it. If nothing else, as we all know, asymmetric warfare, as it's called, anything that makes it possible for a small entity to exhibit the might and prowess of a major entity by investing in a technology, that will be done. All I was getting at was that there comes a point at which the legitimate questions of national statehood, of sovereignty of a nation, also get confabulated with the interests of what had been an industrial world and is now a digital world. It should come as no surprise to us, I think, that those who, and this is not a leftish comment at all, but those who profit from war in material and machinery, will be supplanted in time by those who profit in war in digital goods. And that should come as no surprise. It's simply the evolution of human nature, I guess, coupled to technology.
Now, one of the things Eisenhower was worried about was not only that the military-industrial complex would seek to sort of sustain itself by any means sort of necessary, but also that it could wind up with undue influence over policy. So it's the whole concept of the tail wagging the dog. Now, I wonder if this isn't perhaps a bigger problem if we're discussing a military digital complex because of the asymmetric nature of the digital threat.
It certainly could be. I think one of the, as you perhaps know, I frequently use analogies from nature in trying to think about security. And one of those, of course, is if you study the process of evolution, you will quickly find that it doesn't move at a smooth curve. It's not a steady 8% grade or something like that. It's much more occasional big surprises followed by a period of adjustment, what Stephen Jay Gould called a punctuated equilibrium. Now, we are at one of those just now, and I think it bears on this question. The one we are at just now is the sudden changeover, relatively sudden changeover, from the attack class being amateurs and braggarts to people who are professional and quite likely military, that changeover is one that results in having the opposition be invisible. And one of the things an invisible opposition wishes to do is to not only have its power, but sustain its power by making it hard to find. The reason that is a evolutionary equilibrium punctuator is, I think, it, for example, completely negates the entire problem statement behind network security as we ordinarily think of it. Network security says, I'm okay, you're okay, and the internet is a problem. In a world in which the opposition owns a fair percentage of the machines, and there's a lot of estimates of this, there have been 5 published in the last 18 months, and the lowest one was 30, so we'll take that. Suppose 30% of all desktop machines are already owned by somebody else. If that's the case, the basic premise of network security is no longer valid, because it isn't I'm okay, you're okay. It's I'm okay, I think. I have to assume you're owned, and the internet may make this worse. Now, that is a very different kind of environment, and it is the environment in which it becomes possible to have two things that matter here. One is, it's the environment in which it makes it possible for there to be a permanent state of mild warfare, cold warfare, if you will. And the other is that once that happens, who owns the machine is now an open question. In an environment in which the ability to own remote machines is so advanced amongst amateurs and criminals that we have a situation where 30% are already compromised, and the basic premise of network security is thereby negated, why would we think otherwise than that that would also be true of nation states attempting to do the same thing? And secondarily, their suppliers, whoever those suppliers are, their suppliers of the technology for this become just as influential, if not more so, just as you said, if not more so than airplane manufacturers and munitions manufacturers and radar manufacturers and so forth became at the time when Eisenhower made his speech. They're going to be that much more influential because, if nothing else, they don't have to respect borders and their tools do not have to be visible. I mean, a bomber or a train full of munitions or a fixed radar installation in Alaska or whatever, these things are not secrets. But the tools we are talking about are, by their very definition, secret. And the fact they are secret, the suppliers achieve a relationship with those they supply that is far harder both to ascertain and to affect than it would be if what we were talking about is who sells refueling aircraft.
But I can imagine that it would be a lot more difficult to create, and this is the thing that I find a little bit frightening about all of this, is that it's a lot more difficult to create something as mundane as a refueling aircraft than it is to create a relatively nasty online threat. I mean, you could have a team of three or four people. I'm sure you know, and I know, three or four people that if we put in a room together and said, come up with something diabolical, they'd be able to. But you know, you take three guys and put them in the same room and said, build me a beautiful, wonderful, highly functional refueling aircraft, they still won't be able to do it, will they?
That's correct. The one place where you might have the same fear is, you know, the two or three mad crackpot problem could well be in biotechnology, which is not my field.
I don't even want to think about that.
Well, nevertheless, that's the one other place that you might find this is in biotech. Where I think release of something bad would be more likely to be an accident than it would be in the field we're talking about. But nevertheless, it's the only other thing I can think of where a single crackpot might make a difference. Now, of course, in the digital sphere, the suppliers can sell to governments anywhere, regardless of their current location. And they can sell to governments actually rather more invisibly than you could if what you were supplying is aircraft. Aircraft have to be delivered, and it's hard to make it a secret. Warships have to be delivered, and it's hard to make it a secret. Digital goods do not have to be delivered in public. And again, the relationship between those who are buying and those who are selling can be as incestuous as you would like because it's invisible.
How far down this road do you think we are in terms of the emergence of the military digital complex? Do you think this is something that is already established, or it's something that's coming to the fore now?
It would seem to me likely that this kind of thing arises independently in different places, that in some sense, by the time you know it is pervasive, it has already been present for a while. That, you know, way overquoted William Gibson remark about the future's already here, it's just unevenly distributed, I think applies to this quite well. I think it's already in place. I think it's already in place in various ways that I don't know how to estimate, but I can tell you one thing that would be quite interesting. If you could ask a question and get an answer, you know, if you could go to the Oracle and say, I only have one question, can I have a true answer? And the Oracle would give you a true answer. And that would be, how much are questions of digital offense outsourced to private operators?
I'd hazard a guess it would be quite high. I had a similar discussion with Marcus Ranham a couple of months ago where he said, in which he said that, yeah, the good guys don't go to the government because the government just doesn't pay.
Oh, good in the sense of expert.
Yes, good in the sense of expert, not good as in pure of soul.
I do have to make sure what good we're talking about here. Yeah, in the sense of expert, well, there's certainly parts of the world where That would be your only alternative to earn a living wage. If it's an auction, again, the problem with it being invisible is that you're not going to get an auction market.
Mm.
You're going to get somebody who knocks on your door and says, whatever they're paying you, I'll double it. And you're going to say, I wonder if I could do better. No, you're not. You're going to say, that's fantastic. I'll take it. And my guess is that at the moment, anyway, you know, that by some loose definition, organized crime is a high bidder.
Mm.
But if there is an evolutionary event going on now, it is changing over from organized crime being the high bidder to clandestine agencies being the high bidder. Now, again, I have no information about this. This is simply trying to think about this as like a ballistics problem. The position of this thing is so such and such. Its velocity is such and such. If I do nothing, where does it land?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me the position and velocity of this is that it lands as an incestuous relationship between suppliers and buyers of tools which, by their very nature, are more valuable if they're invisible. And the fact that they're being bought and sold is invisible. And the fact that they're being deployed is invisible. And the fact that those against whom they're deployed can't tell that that is what has happened, but nevertheless, it has.
Of course, in times of economic uncertainty, of which we are, you know, in which we are firmly rooted at the moment, I think it's fair to say, Dan, government spending generally tends to kick up to keep things ticking over. Do you think that the trouble that we've had in the markets of late has the potential to accelerate this trend?
In one way, if you have a wide choice of customers, you will make a general product. If you have a narrow choice of customers, you will make a specialized product. It's entirely possible that government, as the buyer of last resort for a variety of things, may narrow the kinds of tools to ones that are only useful for them. There's been talk, as you well know, for eons about, well, we'd only have secure computers. Desktop machines would be secure if only the government would insist on buying that, put it in their procurement regs and so forth. I think that's baloney, but it's a constant. I do think that it would be true that very unusual things would be available if it was thought that government will want to procure them on a single source basis. I don't think government curing the general security problem by only buying PCs with a certain kind of something or other is going to solve anything. The install base is too large. But we're not talking about an install base here. We're talking about things which are cutting edge, things where, I don't know if it's true in your country, I know in this country there's certain kinds of things where if you file a patent and the patent is thought to be of particular interest to the clandestine services, the patent will be seized. You'll be compensated, but it'll be seized. I don't have any info. You'll never know what that rate is because at least in the country I'm sitting in, patent filings are secret until granted. So that would never show up, but maybe some countries where patent filings are a public document per se, it'd be interesting to see what percentage of them are being seized, if that's something you could do. But you get what I'm saying. The very nature of this is, because you can't see it, your supposition has to be, what would be the natural process regardless of my ability to observe it? And the natural process here has got to be, I think, because in the first world, the digital arena is now so much an essential component of life as we know it. And the financial world has just decided that we're going to have world government one way or the other. Why would we not now have, as it were, the pressure and the threat and what have you move from the physical world to the digital world, just as we've decided that borders in the physical world are yielding to borders in the financial world, which are very different. The Bank of International Settlements and its clients, the International Monetary Fund and its clients and so forth, have a different sense of borders and who's in charge. We're going to have the same thing in the digital sphere, only because it is the last redoubt of sovereignty, I think it's going to be a much more vicious game.
Okay, well, Dan Gear, thank you very much for spending some time with Risky Business.
You're entirely welcome. Let's hope that we're all wrong.
There you go, industry legend Dan Gear on the line there from the USA. Now, most listeners would have heard about Microsoft's SDL, or Secure Development Lifecycle. It was all about tightening up Microsoft's engineering and coding practices and making them more robust to reduce the number of vulnerabilities that they actually had to deal with in their finished product. Now, Microsoft, who is, of course, this week's sponsor, used to be a laughingstock in the security world. But that all changed quite rapidly, and one of the internal initiatives that helped shape things up involved creating the secure development lifecycle. And the SDL big kahuna is Steve Lipner, who's been in computer science as long as I've been alive. Well, here's some good news for independent software vendors. Microsoft is about to share some of its whizbang SDL tools with you, as you'll hear in this week's sponsor interview with Microsoft's Steve Lipner.
That's correct. We have announced that we're making available our threat modeling tool, the SDL threat modeling tool 3.0, the SDL optimization model, which is what you might think of as a capability maturity model for implementing the SDL. And we've also launched the SDL Pro network of consulting and services partners who can work with customers to implement the SDL.
Now, I understand this was always actually the plan with SDL.
That's correct. We actually released a white paper on the SDL at the end of 2004, and then Michael Howard and I wrote a book about the SDL that was published in the summer of 06. So we've continued to release additional information about the SDL along the way, and our plan is to get more and more of it out as time and resources and the maturity of the information permits.
Now, why has it actually taken so long? You mentioned that this was mentioned in 2004, as early as then, but it's 2008 and we're just starting to see some action now.
Well, actually, there's a lot of detail, including training material and a fuzzing tool, as well as internal process information in the SDL book that we released in 2006. And then we also released detailed process guidance on the SDL based on the 3.2 version that we implement internally and made that available free on the web earlier this year. So it has been an ongoing process, and the reason it takes a while is just to sort of clean up the internal Microsoft sites and what have you.
When you write something for your own use, you can get away with murder, but when you have to put it in a shrink-wrapped box, it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, it's not shrink-wrapped in the sense that we're charging for it, but it's still going outside the company, and so we need to make sure that people can understand it and use it.
Yeah, and people will laugh at you if it crashes.
Well, there is that.
Yeah. So as a percentage of the total tools available to the average Microsoft developer, how much of it is actually now going outside?
That's a great question. So probably 80 to 90% of the process guidance is available outside, and probably somewhere in the 50-ish percent range of tools are available outside. We have, in some cases, when I'm saying that, I'm sort of applying windage based on the fact that there are externally available versions of tools that we have our own internal customized versions of in some cases.
Mm-hmm. And what's the uptake been thus far?
Actually, I don't know download counts on the SDL guidance on the web. The threat modeling tool and the optimization model will be released in November, so we don't have them out there yet.
Mm-hmm. Will there be fanfare, ribbon cutting, corks popping?
I'm not sure how much fanfare there'll be beyond the press announcements and the press pass article a couple of weeks ago. There's an SDL portal on the web. I don't know if you've seen that or not. Microsoft.com/SDL, and I think you can take it for sure that there'll be big headlines when we actually have the tools live for download.
Mm-mm. So what is it exactly that you're hoping to achieve with this release?
We're hoping to make the internet ecosystem a more secure place. I mean, you know, that's sort of a highfalutin way to say it, but one of the things that we've started to see is that operating systems and infrastructure software are representing a smaller and smaller percentage of the security incidents, security attacks, security vulnerabilities reported. And so by releasing these tools and guidance, we're hoping that we'll make it easier for developers who build software, especially software that runs on Windows, to do that more securely.
And which types of organizations do you think will run with it? Is it going to be the smaller ISVs, do you think? I mean, don't the big ones already have their own sort of processes for developing secure code?
A batch of big ISVs have processes for developing secure code. We think some of them may at least check out what we've done to see how that compares. Small ISVs, we want to reduce the cost of entry, you know, make it easier for them to figure out what to do and do it. Internal in-house IT shops, people who build applications for their own use, another important audience. If you're either building systems to offer services to customers or building systems for internal use, those have security requirements too. And that's another audience that we think can use the information and tools.
Was it a difficult thing to convince brass at Microsoft to actually release some of its intellectual property and some of its, you know, something that it portrays as a competitive advantage, which is SDL? Was it hard to convince the top brass to allow that to leak out onto the internet?
Well, it's not a leak if you put it there. The point of the SDL is to make the customers more secure. And so no, it really wasn't hard to convince folks that this was something we wanted to do. The questions were basically, you know, is it ready and will people be able to use it? And we think the answers to those things are yes and yes. And that, of course, also goes back to your question about why it's taken so long.
Okay, well, Steve Lipner, that's all we've got time for, but thanks a lot for talking to Risky Business.
Okay, thank you very much, Patrick.
And that's it for this week's show. Big thanks to all of our guests, and sorry we were a little bit late getting the show up and done this week, but hey, it's been a little bit hectic. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.